will sit on the throne of his glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate people one from another as shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will put the sheep at his right hand and the goats at the left. Then the king will say to those at his right hand, come, you that are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you took care of me. I was in prison, and you visited me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when was it that you saw you hungry, that we saw you hungry and gave you food, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? And when was it that we saw you a stranger and welcomed you, or naked and gave you clothing? And when was it that we saw you sick or in prison and visited you? And the king will answer them, truly I tell you, as you did it to one of the least of these who are the members of my family, you did it to me. Then he will say to those at his left hand, you that are accursed, depart from me into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me. Naked, and you did not give me clothing. Sick, and in prison, and you did not visit me. Then they will also answer, Lord, when was it that we saw you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not take care of you? And he will answer them, truly I tell you, just as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life.
Insane when you think about it. went to college. So my neighbors, I mean, they definitely were my neighbors, even though we lived in the same dorm, because they weren't my friends, they weren't my family. They were this sort of middle space, like in proximity to me, these individual humans, but in a sort of unclear relationship to myself. And the reason I want to share about them a little bit is because they were also the strangest people. They were the most strange, in the sense of stranger and strange, people I've ever sort of been that close to. They were like, they were sort of, if you imagine, like, you know, there's polar opposites, but like, if there are three things that could be polar opposites, so maybe like an equilateral triangle where each person is like one point and we're all extremely different from one another. And like, so one of them, I won't say their names in case they listen to this podcast, but they'll, if we put this online, but it's, I'm going to be nice in the end, don't worry. One of them grew up in London, went to one of the fanciest prep schools there is, like one of the princes may have gone there, or like they rode against them, Prince William. His family owned houses all over the world, in Barbados, in Manhattan, and he was dating the great-great-great-granddaughter of Tolstoy, a social aristocrat. She was really sweet, I liked her. And yeah, kind of very, very pretentious. He ate in the dining hall the first day of school. And that was the last time he ate in the dining hall. Every other meal he had, he ate out during these clubs in Boston. The other roommate was from Maryland, and he was a lacrosse player. He took all of his classes sort of in consultation with his coach, and would get drunk and break things in the dorm. And whenever anything was like not so chill, he would call it gay. So it was like all the things that I used to define myself, I felt were like under constant attack by these people. And I grew up in the Midwest, my dad was the civil servant, my mom was an artist. I thought of myself as this idealistic, you know, left-wing person who was gonna change things. I was in the modern dance company, a lot of my friends were gay. And it was just living in this place felt like I was under siege. And I would kind of tell everyone my plight, all my friends, they would have sympathy for me. And at one point I devised a strategy. So I decided that the best way would be to kind of kill them with kindness. So I sort of formed alliances with each of them because they didn't like each other either. Their kind of personalities clashed. So I was a little Machiavellian because I thought if they were pitted against each other, they couldn't team up on me, and I don't know what they would do, just sort of make my life miserable. So I felt completely justified in my dislike of these guys. I felt like it was not rooted in their difference from me, the fact that they were strange to me, because I loved meeting people who were different from me, and my friends were different in lots of ways, and I thought that was like a source of richness and new experiences and new knowledge. So I loved difference, I loved the strange, I loved the weird, but this was a kind of strange that I felt had sort of a moral dimension. I felt like it wasn't just that it was different, it was that it was harmful. And I felt like my solidarity with the least of these was with, you know, the gay people who would be offended carrying my jock roommate, or the sort of workers that my, you know, young aspiring capitalist would one day oppress. Completely justified in my dislike for these kids. We did have one thing in common. We were all exactly 6'3". We were all exactly the same height, which was really funny. So I think whoever decided how to win people is a simple formula. I was listening to NPR recently, and there were people talking about the Israel-Palestine conflict, and they played a little snippet of Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, talking about how they had apprehended a suspect in the murder of this Palestinian boy, which was done presumably by an Israeli Jew in retaliation for the murders of three Jews in the West Bank. And he said, I pledge that the perpetrators of this horrific crime, which must be resolutely condemned in the most forceful language, will face the full weight of the law. I know that in our society, the society of Israel, there is no place for such murderers. And that's the difference between us and our neighbors. They consider murderers to be heroes. They name public squares after them. We don't. We condemn them, and we put them on trial, and we put them in prison. So, again, the neighbor, I was just fascinated because I was thinking about neighbors, and I thought it was so fascinating. It says our neighbors, we're different from our neighbors. And what makes us different from our neighbors is that they do bad things. They don't have the sort of moral core that we have. That it's not that they're just different, or they look different, they speak a different language, or they have a different history, or they live in a different way. It's that there's a kind of moral baseness, moral, something they're lacking that we possess. And we, in our identity, in our core, in our society, we don't have that same moral sickness that they have. We're better than that. And I happen to hear that example, but I know for a fact that on the other side, they say the same exact thing. That the harmers, the ones who are doing the violence, the true base violence, not the justified kind that we're doing, are over there. That's our strange neighbor's problem, not our problem. So I'm not trying to like just point out one side's hypocrisy. And I find that's sort of, in some way, what I do, but kind of to both sides when I hear about the conflict. Like when I was growing up, I remember trying to understand it, and my dad saying, oh, they just hate each other. It's sort of like, they both are like that. They're both just kind of bad, and they have this tragic, horrible history that makes them hate one another and continue the cycle of violence, and it never will stop, and there's kind of this fatalistic thing. So it's not always, we don't always just do it to someone we're opposed to, I think. And I think that kind of thinking is exactly why I've kind of shrugged my shoulders often. That conflict, other conflicts, and sort of felt there's nothing I can do. If there is sort of, if there are some least of these involved that I should attempt to care for and maybe do something about, how do I even begin to identify where that would lead me if both are kind of suffering from this strange, hard to pinpoint, but basically inevitably bad core. In the quote that Thomas Merton said, first of all, I love that, and I don't know if there's a picture I wanted. There's a plaque, an actual plaque, in Louisville, with that quote about people are shining like the sun, which I just think is such a gorgeous, gorgeous image.
Behind you.
Oh, it's there! Oh! I was going to try to describe the plaque is brown and has bronze words and there's a white rat in it. Yeah, so this is really cool. I mean, just imagine walking down the street. I haven't been there. Yeah, Merton had a sudden insight at this corner, March 18th, 1958. That led him to redefine his masculinity with greater involvement in social justice issues. So at this point, in 1958, he had already been a monk. I don't know if people heard of Thomas Merton, I don't want to mansplain this to death, but he had been a monk for 17 years. at this point. He grew up in a pretty secular existence. Was a brilliant writer and kind of in intellectual artistic circles in New York, and kind of obviously evolved to lead this monastic life. And after 17 years of living in this kind of separate way that he felt was a truer way, a way kind of that avoided the pitfalls of living in modern civilization and got to something real, he was walking down the street and had this vision. He was suddenly overwhelmed with the realization that I loved all these people. He found them walking around shining like the sun. And that just amazes me that after 17 years of like trying to be a good, holy, loving person, that he could have such a profound experience of awakening to the reality of other human beings and like kind of see them in all their preciousness and sacredness. Like, shouldn't he have been doing that already? Like, if it took him 17 years, like, how the hell are we gonna do that? But also, I was talking with Patrick about this story, and he's like, that gives me hope. It's a really hopeful thing. And I think he's absolutely right, because I don't know about you guys, but I certainly don't feel, I don't always walk around. I mean, right now, you guys are all blazing and suns, like, jumping up. But you know, in my daily life, I don't always feel that way or experience people that way. There's this kind of revelation of breaking in to my reality, this reality from, I don't know where, this mysterious other presence of people that's beautiful and glorious. But in his quote, what's so cool, so he attributes part of his reason for not having experienced people that way to the same thing that led him to the monastery in the first place, which was to kind of unplug, kind of separate himself from the hustle, muscle, busyness, flow, the kind of pressures of socialization, of conforming to these arbitrary or socially defined roles. But that very separateness, that very set apart quality, he suddenly saw that it kind of insidiously made him feel separate from his fellow human beings. That like viewing this sort of path of the holy or the sort of more reflective or the truer, the ones who seek beauty and God, kind of lifted him out of just the kind of random people walking on the street. And even when he has this exhilarating experience of connection with people, of seeing them as glorified, beautiful beings, he still says that they're strangers. Like, I love that. He's like, he says, I no longer felt alienated from these strangers. It's not kind of a mushy, we're all one, we're all like, the egos are all gone. They're still strangers to him. And then he talks about, I don't know if you remember in the quote, about this beautiful core that he experienced of the people that he wished they could see for themselves, he wasn't sure, but this beautiful core that neither sin nor desire nor self-knowledge could even penetrate. Like this core in them that they weren't even really aware of. This like mysterious, totally particular, totally unique something that even as he was feeling so unified and so connected and at one with all of these people just walking down the street, he still experienced this mysterious thing that he couldn't penetrate, they couldn't even quite know, but somehow God sees, is how he puts it. If we could only see how God sees. In psychology, psychoanalysis, there's this term, phantasm, which kind of means like a fantasy or a sort of ghost or a kind of an illusory reality that somehow is deep in us. It's, you know, in our unconscious, we don't really have access to it, but it determines how we move and experience the world and what we think is important and not important, how we define ourselves in relation to others. Thomas Merton talks about feeling like he woke up from a dream, phantasm, in this moment. in psychoanalysis, they talk about how these phantasms, they're sort of like, this thinker that I have been reading that I really like, his name's Eric Santner, talks about them as being undead. You know, undead is like, a vampire is undead, zombie is undead. There's this thing that seems alive, that is like moving and talking, or like just walking like this or whatever, but it's dead. But somehow it's animated, it has energy, and some kind of seeming life. And I think that idea that like you could be living in a monastery, writing, working to be whole, be holy, and still feel like, looking backwards, I was asleep, I was moving on autopilot, I was undead, is something we should take really seriously. That these phantasms are in us, whether we want to admit it or not. And, you know, the question, you know, psychoanalysis would say you have to go to like psychoanalysis 4 times a week for years to like start to get to know this part of yourself, and sort of either, I don't really want to think about it, but maybe like pop these phantasms or release their grip on us in some way. But I was thinking in that there's a practice that Christians do, that Jews do, that Muslims do, that is another way of getting in touch with these sort of weird zombie-like things that make us move through reality, kind of not noticing one another. And it's called confession. And confession, you know, the popular understanding is like you go in a little booth and you like tell all these horrible things you've done. But I think that the most powerful thing about confession is not necessarily the particular, like, oh, I was a jerk this morning when I was rude to the person at the bus or whatever, or like, oh, I haven't been calling my mom. The specifics are good, but the real good thing about it, the real powerful thing that we don't get hardly anywhere else, unless you live in a monastery, but then you can going to psychoanalysis 4 times a week, is just the acknowledgement that there is this strange part of ourselves that comes from the same thing that makes us who we are, this strange part of ourselves that's a stranger to us, but that is determining how we move, and it's also keeping us estranged from each other. It's keeping us estranged from a kind of fullness of life that's really possible. And you don't even have to know everything about that stranger in yourself. Because part of the definition is you can't. It's sort of, there's this weird idea in Christianity, and I think in Judaism too, of like, you need to keep doing confession your whole life. Like, it's not like, once you have the vision, or you're like saved or justified or you're awakened, you stop having this stranger inside. It's something you need to kind of keep acknowledging. So it's something we can acknowledge, but maybe not completely know. When I think about those roommates, those neighbors, and why I couldn't stand them so much, I still, the first thing I think of is like, these guys suck. These guys were like, they just were not cool dudes. And like, it was, and I haven't let go of those sort of convictions that justified my dislike of them. But if I really am honest with myself about why I couldn't stand them so much, it wasn't my convictions. I mean, that didn't quite explain the visceral dislike of these two people I shared a room with. By the way, so if someone can give you a picture of her closet, in my the closet, just can't get this out. You know, there were like all my plaid thrift store shirts that I still wear. And then on one side there was sort of like, you know, the like lacrosse jerseys or just kind of random Banana Republic stuff. And then the other side, I'm not kidding, were like 12 Armani suits. That was just like, can you imagine walking into a closet like that? But nevertheless, I think what was really going on is I was kind of a pretty insecure first year college student, like who clung pretty tightly to my identity as like anti Harvard, as like I'm different, I'm like going to smash this bastion of privilege and elitism. I am, you know, and sort of, I felt though very scared. I felt very threatened by this new place that I was in, you know, coming from my high school where I was the big fish in the medium small pond, being in like a pond where everyone was a big fish that I came from. And my sort of strange, undead, zombie self that was formed in this illusory way, but that kind of determined how I walked, how I saw things, how I felt, had been formed to think it was worthwhile, think I was worthwhile because of my ability to be the smartest one in the room, my ability to be the hot shot, the one, the achiever, the one who's recognized. So my sort of zombie self, my strange self that within me was terrified that I wasn't worthy of that love anymore. And so when we confess, which we're going to show our little confessions on the thing, I like to think of it as meeting that stranger in ourselves, not feeling like, oh my God, I am the one in the room who's messed up, everyone else is okay, we're all strangers, we all have strange stuff about ourselves. Not as like a stranger in a scary sense, but as a strange, as just kind of like, wow, I'm strange, I'm weird. like we're all weird in our different ways. We're all sort of shaped in these funny lopsided ways that make us look at the world in a slightly askew way, kind of misperceive what's really going on, view threats where they're not there. But rather than like beating ourselves to a pulp, just be like, oh, that's strange. But really feeling how, oh, that's strange can block us from love, block us from experiencing God's love, from experiencing love from others and to others. And then, so it's not like, man, I suck because I'm so weird. It's like, oh, I'm weird. That's, everyone's weird. How does my weirdness, my particular off-kilterness block that love? And just to, before I finish, a real quick aside, because I've totally avoided the last lines. Remember the last lines from the gospel passage where Jesus, who's supposed to be exhibiting this kind of love, loving us in all our particular strangeness, like being revealed when we are able to love the stranger, literally says, the ones who are strange to us. But he says, like, there's this weird time of judgment when he's going to separate the good ones, the sheep, from the goats, the bad ones, and the good ones get eternal life, this kind of exuberant fullness of life here in this world, but in some kind of eternal or everlasting way. But then the ones who fail to do it, they're just like damned for eternal punishment. So I was trying to think about that punishment stuff. How is that loving? How is what he's saying loving? And the one other place where that word for punishment comes up in the New Testament is in 1 John, to the letter, where no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not reached perfection in love. So that word right there is the same one as here, where like, if you fail to love the least of these, not just the ones who are obviously poor or homeless or the ones we're supposed to love, we all know we should love, but the ones who are maybe least like us or least able to connect with us, like Mary Mates, that what we're really doing is not setting us up for some kind of like eternal afterlife punishment of fire and little prodding demons with pitchforks, but like the sort of we're punishing ourselves. We're sort of we're living in fear. The punishment is the fear that's preventing us from opening to God and to one another. That is the punishment. It's the fear of that judgment that is the judgment itself. And the other thing I think, the reason that it's eternal is that my interpretation of that is it's sort of a little math equation. That the eternity of this life or this punishment, this living just in kind of fear and disconnection, it's eternal because it's eternally up to us, or like infinitely something you shouldn't procrastinate. Meaning that it's not something like when things slow down, when I can go on a retreat, when I can take a break, that I need to do this kind of this work of honest acknowledgement, checking in with how I'm doing. It's something we need to do now and every day. That it's eternally important, and the consequences are eternal. Not to freak you out. But it's also something that we don't